Philip's eyes were darting from one to the other. He looked like a man who had felt certain that he stood on solid granite, and had suddenly discovered that it was thin ice, now cracking open all around him. He tried and stopped. His voice sounded like steps testing the ice. But don't I have any freedom of speech?
In your own house, not in mine.
Don't I have any right to my own ideas?
At your own expense, not at mine.
Don't you tolerate any differences of opinion?
Not when I'm paying the bills.
Isn't there anything involved but money?
Yes, the fact that it's my money.
Don't you want to consider any he—
He was going to say higher, but changed his mind.
Any other aspects?
No.
But I'm not your slave.
Am I yours?
I don't know what you—
He stopped. He knew what was meant.
No, said Reardon.
You're not my slave. You're free to walk out of here any time you choose.
I'm not speaking of that.
I am.
I don't understand it.
Don't you?
You've always known my political views. You've never objected before.
That's true, said Reardon gravely.
Perhaps I owe you an explanation if I have misled you.
I've tried never to remind you that you're living on my charity. I thought that it was your place to remember it. I thought that any human being who accepts the help of another knows that goodwill is the giver's only motive, and that goodwill is the payment he owes in return. But I see that I was wrong.
You were getting your food unearned, and you concluded that affection did not have to be earned either.
You concluded that I was the safest person in the world for you to spit on precisely because I held you by the throat. You concluded that I wouldn't want to remind you of it, and that I would be tied by the fear of hurting your feelings. All right, let's get it straight. You're an object of charity who's exhausted his credit long ago. Whatever affection I might have felt for you once is gone. I haven't the slightest interest in you, your fate, or your future. I haven't any reason whatever for wishing to feed you. If you leave my house, it won't make any difference to me whether you starve or not. Now, that is your position here, and I will expect you to remember it if you wish to stay. If not, then get out.
But for the movement of drawing his head a little into his shoulders, Philip showed no reaction.
Don't imagine that I enjoy living here, he said.
His voice was lifeless and shrill. If you think I'm happy, you're mistaken. I'd give anything to get away. The words pertained to defiance, but the voice had a curiously cautious quality.
If that is how you feel about it, it would be best for me to leave.
The words were a statement, but the voice put a question mark at the end of it and waited. There was no answer.
You needn't worry about my future. I don't have to ask favors of anybody. I can take care of myself all right.
The words were addressed to Reardon, but the eyes were looking at his mother. She did not speak. She was afraid to move.
I've always wanted to be on my own. I've always wanted to live in New York near all my friends.
The voice slowed down and added in an impersonal, reflective manner, as if the words were not addressed to anyone.
Of course, I'd have the problem of maintaining a certain social position. It's not my fault if I'll be embarrassed by a family name associated with a millionaire. I would need enough money for a year or two to establish myself in a manner suitable to my—
You won't get it from me.
I wasn't asking you for it, was I? Don't imagine that I couldn't get it somewhere else if I wanted to. Don't imagine that I couldn't leave. I'd go in a minute, if I had only myself to think about. But Mother needs me, and if I deserted her—
Don't explain.
And besides, you misunderstood me, Henry. I haven't said anything to insult you. I wasn't speaking in any personal way. I was only discussing the general political picture from an abstract sociological viewpoint, which—
Don't explain, said Reardon. He was looking at Philip's face. It was half lowered, its eyes looking up at him. The eyes were lifeless, as if they had witnessed nothing. They held no spark of excitement, no personal sensation, neither of defiance nor of regret, neither of shame nor of suffering. They were filmy ovals that held no response to reality, no attempt to understand it, to weigh it, to reach some verdict of justice. Ovals that held nothing but a dull, still, mindless hatred.
Don't explain. Just keep your mouth shut.
The revulsion that made Reardon turn his face away contained a spasm of pity. There was an instant when he wanted to seize his brother's shoulders, to shake him, to cry, "How could you do this to yourself? How did you come to a stage where this is all that's left of you? Why did you let the wonderful fact of your own existence go by?" He looked away. He knew it was useless. He noted in weary contempt that the three at the table remained silent. Through all the years past, his consideration for them had brought him nothing but their maliciously righteous reproaches. Where was their righteousness now? Now was the time to stand on their code of justice. If justice had been any part of their code, why didn't they throw at him all those accusations of cruelty and selfishness, which he had come to accept as the eternal chorus to his life? What had permitted them to do it for years? He knew that the words he heard in his mind were the key to the answer. The sanction of the victim. "Don't let's quarrel," said his mother, her voice cheerless and vague. "It's Thanksgiving Day." When he looked at Lillian, he caught a glance that made him certain she had watched him for a long time. Its quality was panic. He got up. "You will please excuse me now," he said to the table at large. "Where are you going?" asked Lillian sharply. He stood looking at her for a deliberate moment, as if to confirm the meaning she would read in his answer. "To New York." She jumped to her feet.
"Tonight?"
"Now."
"You can't go to New York tonight?"
Her voice was not loud, but it had the imperious helplessness of a shriek.
"This is not the time when you can afford it. When you can afford to desert your family, I mean, you ought to think about the matter of clean hands. You're not in a position to permit yourself anything which you know to be depravity."
By what code? Thought Reardon. By what standard?
"Why do you wish to go to New York tonight?"
"I think, Lillian, for the same reason that makes you wish to stop me.
Tomorrow is your trial."
"That is what I mean." He made a movement to turn, and she raised her voice.
"I don't want you to go."
He smiled. It was the first time he had smiled at her in the past 3 months. It was not the kind of smile she could care to see.
"I forbid you to leave us tonight."
He turned and left the room. Sitting at the wheel of his car with the glassy, frozen road flying at his face and down under the wheels at 60 miles an hour, he let the thought of his family drop away from him, and the vision of their faces went rolling back into the abyss of speed that swallowed the bare trees and lonely structures of the roadside. There was little traffic and few lights in the distant clusters of the towns he passed. The emptiness of inactivity was the only sign of a holiday. A hazy glow, rusted by frost, flashed above the roof of a factory once in a rare while, and a cold wind shrieked through the joints of his car, beating the canvas top against the metal frame. By some dim sense of contrast, which he did not define, the thought of his family was replaced by the thought of his encounter with the wet nurse, the Washington boy of his mills. At the time of his indictment, he had discovered that the boy had known about his deal with Daneker, yet had not reported it to anyone. "Why didn't you inform your friends about me?" he had asked. The boy had answered brusquely, not looking at him.
"Didn't want to."
"It was part of your job to watch precisely for things of that kind, wasn't it?"
"Yeah."
"Besides, your friends would have been delighted to hear it."
"I know."
"Didn't you know what a valuable piece of information it was? And what a stupendous trade you could have pulled with those friends of yours in Washington, whom you offered to me once, remember? The friends who always occasion expenses?" The boy had not answered. "It could have made your career at the very top level. Don't tell me that you didn't know it."
"I knew it."
"Then why didn't you make use of it?"
"I didn't want to."
"Why not?"
"Don't know."
The boy had stood glumly avoiding Reardon's eyes, as if trying to avoid something incomprehensible within himself. Reardon had laughed. "Listen, non-absolute. You're playing with fire. Better go and murder somebody fast before you let it get you. That reason that stopped you from turning informer. Or else it will blast your career to hell." The boy had not answered.